3 days after the Boston Marathon bombing, authorities searched this city in an epic manhunt for terrorists responsible for placing the bombs near the finish line. Those terrorists turned out to be the two Tsarnaev brothers, Tamerlan and his younger brother Zhahar. That led to a shootout in the Boston suburb of Watertown, the death of the older brother, Tamerlan, and the capture of his younger brother, Zhahar. The shootout in Watertown and the aftermath were the focus of testimony today, day 7. And this is Finish Line, inside the Boston Marathon bombing trial. From the Moakley Federal Courthouse in Boston, I'm David Boeri for WBUR.
And I'm Kevin Cullen of the Boston Globe.
Kevin, the sensation I have today of listening to this testimony was as if I licked my two fingers and put them into an electric socket. There's this galvanic response, no pun intended. This was electrifying.
Yeah, it was this explosion of violence. And I always think that when you say, oh, it was like a Hollywood movie, that's the worst cliche. But it sounded like a Hollywood movie. You have a young cop from Watertown named Joe Reynolds who rounds a corner and comes face-to-face with Zhahar Tsarnaev driving a green Honda. And he does a three-point turn, the cop, and comes back. While he's doing this, he's in contact with his supervisor, John McClellan, a sergeant who says, don't make a stop. There's guns in the car. Don't make a stop until you get backup. And then McClellan becomes that backup, and he says, light him up, Joe. That meaning turn on the blue lights. He never got a chance to light him up because all of a sudden bullets are pinging off his cruiser.
You're right about Hollywood references, and yet there it is. I'm thinking of the gunfight at the OK Corral, and listen to these are the accounts. Officer Joe Reynolds, that's when Tamerlan Tsarnaev got out of his vehicle and began shooting at my cruiser. I ducked down behind the dashboard, threw the cruiser into reverse, and backed up 30 yards. Now, as you mentioned, here comes Sergeant John McClellan. I hear bullets hitting the vehicle. I took a round through the windshield. I put it in drive, jumped out of the vehicle. I let the vehicle go and used it for cover. Kevin,
what
this is like
presence of mind, though, to do something like that.
This is like running behind the horses into the corral. Question from the prosecutor. Did anything else come your way? Answer, yes, thrown explosives.
Just incredible. But McClellan lets the car go, and it was a critical thing because that unmanned cruiser is now attracting fire from Tamerlan Tsarnaev. He pumps rounds into that cruiser, and that would come back to haunt Tamerlan Tsarnaev.
McClellan says, and this is what happens, this gunfight becomes also a bomb-throwing episode. McClellan, the sergeant, says, I noticed one suspect was bigger than the other. The tall one threw the bombs like a baseball pitcher, and the other one, the skinny one, threw it like a hook shot. And here comes Jeffrey Pugilis, the sergeant. He decides, I'm going to go flank the suspect. He says, my pistol ran out of ammunition. I reloaded it in the middle of a firefight. Tamerlan came charging up the street, firing at me. Ultimately, he had a problem. He looked at me, looked at his gun, out of frustration, I think, and he threw the firearm at me.
Yeah, I think that the Tsarnaevs drew very badly that day because Jeff Pugliese is the firearm instructor for Watertown. We're talking about a suburban police department where it's rare that they even pull their guns. A veteran person like John McClellan said he had pulled his gun several times. He had never fired it. And now all three of those officers are emptying their magazines, getting rid of every bullet they carried with them in that firefight.
And to add to this, we have witnesses because, of course, this is a suburb. There are houses all around it. The neighbors are looking out their windows, then hitting the floor. They talk about the explosion.
And I think McClellan said that when it happened, his eyes were shaking violently in his head. He was so disoriented that he actually reholstered his weapon, something he even admitted he shouldn't have done. That's how disorienting, that's how violent that explosion was.
Now, for the defense, this was time for cross-examination. In day 6, last week, the defense had established or tried to establish that it was Tamerlan that killed Sean Collier, the MIT police officer, who had been shot in between the eyes and in the back of the head earlier on Thursday night. Now they try to establish that Zhahar doesn't have a gun. They had a more difficult time here today because two of the officers say they think they see simultaneous muzzle flashes. The defense succeeds somewhat in establishing that it might have been Zhihar lighting a fuse. But what I don't understand is how this necessarily helps them, since they have established that Zhihar is the one that's throwing bombs.
He's hurling bombs at police officers. I don't see the distinction. It seems to me a distinction without a difference.
And the other thing the prosecution has established here is that rather than go out the other way when Zhihar gets into the car and takes off, instead he does a 3-point turn and then comes at the cops who are trying to subdue his brother on the street and having a hard time of it. He comes directly at them as fast as he can. And then we have the description of car hitting something, bumping up, the thumping, screaming of the officers to the fellow officer, get out of the way. Then we have Tamerlan getting caught in the wheels as he goes off.
That was the most revelatory thing for me today of all the testimony, to hear that instead of making the easiest escape route, Zhihar made a 3-point turn, which would have taken some time in the middle of all this, and then came back the other way. I think the only inference we can draw is that he wanted to get at the people that were firing their way. It's the great irony. He killed his brother. That's what the prosecution, that's what Bill Weinreb said in his opening statement. It wasn't the gunshots that Jeff Pugliese fired into him at close range. It was Zhihar running over his own brother. And today we learn in this testimony, it didn't have to happen. He could have gone the other way.
Right. Yet the defense has been able to establish, or actually, perhaps because there's been little resistance from the prosecution, clearly the main actor in this gunfight is Tamerlan Tsarnaev coming at the officers.
Back to the movie metaphor, this is the sort of superhuman taking. Jeff Pugliese said he believed he was hitting him. He thought he was hitting him. As he said, it seemed to have no effect on him. And even after he was run over, he was still resisting. Even after those fatal injuries were inflicted, Tamerlan Tsarnaev is on the ground fighting with the cops.
So it brings me to a question of police response. You have 4,000 cops that descend on Watertown by Friday of that week. All these different competing jurisdictions, often they don't play well together. Here they are. We had, out of the 4,000, there were fish and game guides from Vermont and Maine. The third officer in that whole mix was a postal inspector, and they're all, not all, many of them are coming who are self-deploying.
It was an absolutely chaotic scene.
Now look, is there any reason why they shouldn't presume these guys to be armed and dangerous?
If I was a cop in that situation, I would have expected them to try to kill me.
But it is pretty clear, is it not, that Dick Donahue, the MBTA transit cop, was shot. And it was fire that wasn't coming from the suspect. It was in police fire at the car that's going down.
Well, presumably, if it wasn't police fire, that one of the charges would have been attempted murder of a police officer. There would have been another charge.
And we need to note that story.
He was dead.
Dick
Donahue was dead for about a half an hour. That's what a doctor who treated him testified today.
It was harrowing to hear their descriptions. We get to the next day, of course, and then you have the scene with the boat. It was in somebody's backyard, and into that boat, Zhihar Tsarnaev climbed sometime between, or actually early in the Friday morning, I presume.
Yes, and that's where he was captured.
Wish you could have been with me today to see this boat. I was called in to be a pool reporter. It was stunning to see that. 24-foot boat, riddled with bullets. We counted 110 bullets, but interesting, there was a marking of evidence tape adhering to each hole. I saw one of the evidence numbers, 207.
Wow.
So there were a lot of bullets that went into
that
boat.
From what you saw, though, how could he lie there and not get hit?
Most people look at a boat, and they think of the boat in the top half. And if you look, most of the shots are on the rail. Of course, there's the hull. Mm-hmm. And don't forget, the deck is down below. And he's lying down on the deck, clearly. This is conjecture on my part, that he's so low that he's missing the shots. Now, of course, the boat's not in the water. It's on a trailer. Why they didn't shoot lower, I don't know. Inside the boat, of course, and this is an important thing, it was brought up in testimony earlier in the case, is the statement. The statement that he writes, which the prosecution says is an admission, a confession. It's about why he did what he did, and it has all the notes of the jihadi warrior.
And he also talks about how he was jealous of his own brother because his brother had been martyred.
I thought of the irony. This is a 24-foot boat. Most people would take this boat fishing. Dave Henneberry, its owner, used it for cruising the harbor. And the reason he used it for that, he didn't want any blood or fish scales in the boat, so he never used it to fish. And so you look at the boat now and you're thinking the irony of it.
And you saw there was one scene you described when we were talking about this after, that you, at one point where it's this sort of antiseptic feeling, they're in there going up two by two, the jurors, to look at the boat. You're sitting there looking at the boat. And don't at some point, don't you become aware of Jahar Tsarnaev?
That was, I'm just totally focused on the boat. And all of a sudden I look and I do a double take, because inside the facility we were taken, where the boat was, and we weren't allowed to say where it is. We weren't allowed to say whether it was indoors or outdoors, but if you look at the artist's sketches, you'll see roofs and windows. Make of that what you will. But I look over, and there he is, sitting there, that same look that he generally shows. Hard to read, poker face. He's sitting under a white tent, under the roof, a white tent at a table, flanked by his two lawyers. It was stunning to see. Watched everybody, watched the boat, looked at the boat. I often thought, here's his reintroduction to that boat. What is he thinking? Showed no signs of it. He watched us watching him.
Today's testimony really made me think, how did Jahar Tsarnaev get out of there alive? How did he get off Laurel Street alive? And how did he get out of that boat alive?
That question bothered me today. It bothered me at the time. 200 rounds came in all in one direction, into the boat. He didn't have a weapon, didn't shoot out. Somehow he got out, and that's where we're going tomorrow. This is Finish Line, inside the Boston Marathon bombing trial. I'm David Boeri from WBUR.
And I'm Kevin Cullen from the Boston Globe.
Join us again on Finish Line every day and tomorrow as we expect to hear from the owner of that Watertown boat, the Slipaway 2.
Finish Line, Inside the Boston Marathon Bombing Trial, is a co-production of WBUR and the Boston Globe. New episodes of the podcast will be released multiple times a week throughout the trial after court lets out for the day. You can listen at WBUR.org and at bostonglobe.com, or you can subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, where new episodes will appear as soon as they're released. Go to the podcast section of iTunes and search Finish Line to subscribe. Thanks for listening.